Hi there, House Culture listener. If you enjoy this episode or have enjoyed listening to other episodes in our series, please support and donate to us through the Acast supporter feature. All donations will help us create the content that you love listening to. You can decide how much you give, and there is no regular commitment. So it could be a one-off, and every now and then, or once every time you listen, it's really up to you. Click on the supporter link in the episode description, and with Google or Apple Pay, it will take you less than 30 seconds to make your contribution.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, what's up? This is Joski here from New York City. You're listening to the House Culture Podcast.
House Culture.
Hello everyone, and welcome to the final episode of this season of the House Culture Podcast, hosted as ever by me, the managing editor at House Culture, Matt Rouse. Now, I know you heard the words final episode there, but don't be alarmed. This is the last episode of our fourth season, and we will be back in 2024 with season 5. And even though we're taking a short break, please keep an eye on those feeds. There might be a few special episodes before we get back to releasing regularly. I also want to thank all of you listeners, old and new, who have supported us through 60 episodes of the show. For those newbies, we are House Culture, a collective of house music fans who have come together through their mutual love of the beat to celebrate the spirit of house music. You can find our home on Instagram at HouseCultureNet, so please join us there if you haven't already. These 60 episodes have been a wild ride so far, so thanks to everyone who has listened and supported us over the past 4.5 years. Has it really been that long? If you haven't listened to all of the episodes yet, our off-season is the perfect time for you to dig through the archives and listen to club culture conversations with legends such as David Morales, Roger Sanchez, Harry Romero, Todd Terry, and Chris Lake. We handpick all of our guests to make sure they have fascinating tales to tell. So regardless of their name or profile, get stuck in, as I'm sure you will enjoy listening to their journey through the scene. Speaking of journeys, and things beginning with Jay, our 60th episode is a sit-down with New York-based DJ producer and Maya Recordings label owner Joski, a man that has been part of the scene for over 30 years. We'll hear how an extremely young Joski first broke into the scene.
I'm 17 and now I'm kind of just messing around. I'm connecting, going out to parties. Basically, one thing led to another. I met someone that I ended up getting my first booking. And fast forward a year, 2 years, I'm playing the main floor at Limelight.
His role as a tastemaker behind the decks.
I've never felt like I was like some kind of fucking rock star. I never felt like that. I just play records and my job is to make you guys lose it, you know? Because I've always been like, my job is to sound good.
How he has become a real student of the scene.
Anything I ever got into, I always wanted to learn everything about it. You know, it's important. For me, it was when I started DJing. I wanted to know everything about Paradise Garage, about Chicago, about Ron Hardy, all these guys that are like, wow. Like now I try to find their mixes, you know? Because it's just, you know, that's school 101. That's like history. Know the history of whatever it is you're doing.
And what house culture means to him.
For me, it's just happiness. It's who I am. It's what my life has been. You know what I mean? I can honestly say that my life has been this my whole life, you know what I mean? And I feel so grateful, so much gratitude that it's everything to me, you know what I mean?
I hope you enjoy this one. This is Joski.
House Culture.
Hi, Joski. It's a pleasure to welcome you to the House Culture podcast today. Thanks for finding the time to sit down with us.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
You're welcome. You've been part of the house music scene for over 30 years, playing all over the world, producing anthems of your own across numerous imprints, and you're also the man behind legendary label Mayer Recordings. We really want to dig into all of that, but first, we always like to ask, being born in Brooklyn and raised in Queens, what was your household and neighborhood like, and how did you first discover music there?
Yeah, well, in Brooklyn at that time, this was in the, you know, pretty much in the 70s, mm-hmm. mid to late 70s, it was a different, I mean, it was not the New York it is now, you know what I mean? It was grimy. It was kind of... It was dangerous, you know what I mean? It was rough neighborhoods, you know? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's funny to see all these neighborhoods now are just completely different, you know what I mean? Like, I live in this neighborhood where I live in Bushwick, Brooklyn, mm-hmm. was rough. You know what I mean? This was like a war zone. Now it's just like so expensive to live. It's crazy.
Yeah.
But I mean, I was born in Brooklyn, mm-hmm. and then we moved to Queens, Jackson Heights, which is more a predominantly Latin neighborhood in Queens. Mm-hmm. And I want to say... in the early 80s. And, you know, there were rough neighborhoods, let's be realistic. You know what I mean? There were, that one, like in Queens was predominantly Latino neighborhood. And they were rough. But I mean, you know, I feel like I was just telling my friend this, like, oppression breeds creativity.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, what you find is in these environments, you know, people, the artists move in, right? Because it's a bit rough. It's a bit cheap. It's, you know, there's like a lot going on.
Yeah. Like, you know, I mean, I've gotten mugged so many times, you know what I mean? Growing up as a kid, you know, it's true. Bicycle robbed so many times, you know, it's just, but it's, you know, I appreciate the neighborhoods now, how they've completely changed, you know, mm-hmm. which is great. You know, that's why I still live here. I'm back in Brooklyn. You know, I've been living here since again, you know. Great.
Yeah, I mean, that's great that you've kind of continued that. I mean, we've spoken to people like Danny Tenaglia and Todd Terry on the show as well. And, you know, they have always like lent towards how much of like a melting pot like New York was at that time in terms of culture and music and, you know, all the different influences from like Latino and, you know, all of that environment together in one place kind of really kind of gave you a whole worldview.
Like that neighborhood, I mean, pretty much like a lot of neighborhoods, even where I'm at in Brooklyn or in Queens, they're, you know, they're a melting pot. They're just mixed. Like you walk two blocks and it's all like Indian. Mm-hmm. You walk a few more blocks, it's all like Puerto Rican. It's just like, so, you know, you absorb all that just walking down the streets through these neighborhoods. You know what I mean? It's just music and the food and all that. You know what I mean? That's kind of what I've loved about New York, which is, I guess, why I'm still here, because it's so fucking expensive.
Well, yeah, I mean, especially like you said, you're living in this part of the world now that was cheap back in the day, probably. And now it's like...
those days are over. Yeah, this place is ridiculous, man. It's so expensive here. Just like the cost of living, everything. Mm-hmm. Like, I travel a lot, so I see it. And like, and I travel to all these different states here in this country. Mm-hmm. And just like small things like, okay, you know, just parking your car at the airport. Mm-hmm. You know, some cities here in this country, you know, you could leave your car all day for like 20 bucks. Over here, it's 80.
Man, that is something. That is something. That's crazy. And, you know, so obviously you've seen a lot of change over that time. And I'm sure we'll get into that as we're talking through kind of your career and stuff like that. But, you know, when you were young and like discovering music and, you know, living through that melting pot and all those cultures in the city, you know, what kind of influenced you in terms of taste? Was it your parents? Were you living in a musical household? Was the radio always on? What was going
on
there?
What my, like a big part of my inspiration, like in that, you know, what I think about when I was younger was my parents were really into music. There was music was constantly playing at the house. Mm. And my mom cleaning would have the radio so loud. Like, and it's just, that's what I remember. Like as a kid growing up, my mom cleaning the house, blaring like some of these records that I've sampled now because of that. You know what I mean? Like that Hector Lavoe track that I did, you know, my mom used to always listen to that, the original song. And like, it was like, you know, she loved that record.
Oh, man.
So it was, you know, I remember like, I always find like when I go into the studio, I remember a lot of those times of certain songs that just resonated, you know what I mean? That I've sampled now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And just rediscovering them, I suppose, in a way, or have they always been part of your life? Have you always listened
to
them?
Yeah, they always been. I mean, I've grown up with salsa music. I mean, you know, My family's Colombian, and we grew up basically Colombian, even here in this country. You know what I mean? We barely spoke English in the house, and it was always salsa music and cumbia music playing. So it's just like I feel like that's a big inspiration. I mean, and the fact that I've gotten to work in Colombia a lot throughout the years has been pretty cool too. It's got like a special place for me because it's, like for example, I do these things where I fly to Colombia every year and I work with local musicians in the studio there and just create because there's so much undiscovered talent out there that, these people just amazing, So it's all that comes from the root of it stems from that,
Yeah, and I mean, you can hear that the tinge of that influence throughout your entire career as well. It's something that you've always inputted into all your records and your sound, I found.
Yeah, totally.
And so, in terms of you, obviously, you're huge in the music scene. What was this always the end game? What, did you want to work in music and dance music and
No,
production, all this type of stuff? What was the original
like
out?
my story is this, basically. I'll tell you from the jump, the beginning.
Go.
I was when I was about 13 years old, my sister, I have two sisters, an older and a younger. My older sister, she met this guy that was like obsessed with her. Right? He's this guy was like, he was a disco DJ, but I mean he was like it was his hobby. He had a job and that was always his dream to be this DJ. So he had Technics 1200, an amazing disco collection. And he was obsessed with my sister. And he figured, he's smart. He figured I'm gonna befriend her little brother. Like so she, because she wouldn't pay him, she liked him, but she didn't it wasn't like that. They were friends. But he was obsessed with this. So he befriended me. Remember he told like he you know, we met one time that they were hanging out and he was like, hey man, I have turntables and like records, you should come hang out and check it out. And I was like, all right, I was this little kid, 13 years old. I was like, all right. And I went over to his house and I was just blown away. That was when I got bit by the DJ bug. I was 13 years old and I was just like, whoa, what is this? So it's so funny because now when I think about it in retrospect, like his plan backfired because now I'm banging on his door every day. Like, hey man, I know you're in there. It was a true story. And I could hear him in there and he's just probably like, damn, must be like a Jehovah's Witness or something. And they're banging on the door, just hiding. And that started me on this whole path. You know what I mean? So now it was just something I wanted to do constantly. So I would have the opportunity and mess around on his turntables. And that jump started this. Now, fast forward a few years, I'm 17 and now I'm kind of just messing around. I'm connecting, going out to parties. And even though I wasn't allowed to go out, obviously I was a fake ID. I was going to more gay parties too, because I feel like I wouldn't really get carded so much if you kind of like this young boy walking in. They would just be like, come in. So that's kind of
True.
how I got started in like going out to clubs and all that. And basically, one thing led to another. I met someone that I ended up getting my first booking. And fast forward a year, 2 years, I'm playing the main floor at Limelight. So basically, I've been doing this my whole life. I've had little odd jobs here and there, but this has always kind of been my life from 17 till now.
Wow, that's
So,
incredible.
yeah. So it's been like, I feel so blessed that I was like playing main room at Limelight, 18 years old. I wasn't even allowed to really be in there. You know what I mean? And it was just like in the Roxy, I was really, I was 19, 20 when I was doing the main room there. I'm talking about 3,000 people every Friday.
That is insane. That is insane. So, I mean, for it's like quick, how quickly that accelerated, and obviously you're still really, really young. Were you just super confident in your own ability, or was there any kind
It
of
was it. This is it. I'm the type of person where, if I want to do something, I do it to the extreme. So it was just something like I remember telling my mom, I was like, Mom, I don't want to go to college. It's just like, this is it. I found who I am. And it was just like, oh, but you can't, you need to have something to follow. You don't know if that's gonna work out. I'm like, no, it's gonna work out. I'm gonna make it work out. I'm not taking, I'm gonna make it happen, basically. And it's just I've always kind of had that kind of personality where it's just like, if I want something, I'm gonna just make it do everything in my power to make it happen. So it was the thing where, yeah, I was like, this is it. This is like what I do, and this is who I am, and And, you know, I'm so glad that it worked.
Well, I mean, how amazing that you found something that you loved and you're passionate about and you can make a success of from being so young as well. So, you know, and being able to
and
push that forward.
It's tough, though. It's tough for, like, you know, I have kids now and my daughter, you know, I always kind of like, I know you can't, you know, compare to anybody, but it's just like, I'm always like, when she's like, oh, I don't know what I want to do. I'm like, dude, I was like, I knew what I was doing at 17.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, what can you do? I've got two young kids as well, so yeah, I feel the vibe in that. I mean, so thinking about, like, you know, the Limelight and the Roxy, and when you're playing in there, like, you know, these are venues that we've heard so much about on this podcast. People talk about what were those clubs like, and what was the crowd like, and what type of music were you playing when you were playing there?
We got me started with that. It was just like different times, though, you know. No cell phones. You know, it wasn't like, okay. This is the one thing, you know, I embrace everything that's happening. I mean, I'm glad I'm still, you know, I'm still able to do this and I'm still around to this, to, you know, this generation of kids and everything. It's great. But I mean, there were just different times, you know what I mean? You had less distractions, you know. It wasn't like, you know, people weren't on the dance floor just staring at the DJ. It wasn't, you know, we're not, I've never felt like I was like some kind of fucking rock star. I never felt like that. I just play records and my job is to make you guys lose it, you know. My job is not to perform and, you know, make a spectacle on stage. My job is, I've always been like, my job is to sound good, you know what I mean? So it's just like, you know, when all that changed, I mean, I embrace it because, I mean, hey, we're still here, I love what I do, I love doing this. But yeah, there was just different times. I felt like people were kind of more connected to the music. There wasn't so many distractions. It wasn't kind of like, you know, it was just like people went there to just dance.
Yeah,
it's a different now, you know. It's just, you know, kind of, they want to document everything, they want to remember it. I mean, you know, not that I'm hating on that, because I'm not. I just, you know, it's just different times. Yeah, the crowds were big too back then. I remember, like the Roxy, man, you got 3,000, 4,000 people throughout the night on a every Friday.
Yeah. And so in terms of the Roxy, I mean, it was the Euro Resident at the Together night.
The Together party. Tom Mello, it's the man. I had to mention his name. He's such a good promoter. You know, he kind of was like pivotal in, you know, in my, you know, growth during that time in the like mid-90s, because he was like the best promoter, and he basically made me his DJ, his resident. So it was just like, I got to play with everybody there, you know. I'm like, I just kind of like, just kind of coming up, and I'm like playing with Louis, with Danny Tenaglia, you know, Louis Vega. I mean, I've played with everybody there, you know what I mean? Carl Craig, all the top dogs. I was playing there, and he had this thing where he kind of, I have so much like gratitude towards him, because he said, look, I'm going to make you, you're my DJ, and I'm going to, and he always put me, our names, same size. It was never like, I'm the opener. He did that. And he jump-started my career. Big, big shout out to Tom Mello.
Yeah, that is cool. That is so cool. And, you know, in terms of like residence and having a residency, and you are playing to that crowd that could be coming, the same crowd every week, and you know, you've got that real kind of deeper connection with that crowd than what a headliner might have, or you know, somebody's
amazing,
being booked. How did you play off that? Were you like
I was the closer, so I was like, everybody knew that I closed the night, so you know that I get goosebumps talking about it, because there was some memorable times where I'm just like, there was specific records that I would always play, and they always knew the crowd would sing. It was amazing.
Oh, man.
You know what I mean? Just different times. I remember there was just a few records that one of the records I put on the list, obviously, that I closed with, and another record I used to close with Oscar, was it Merck Together? Records. Huge, you know, Merck fan.
Yeah.
And Oscar, you know, all those guys, and Ralph Falcon. That was one other record I used to play. I remember the whole crowd used to sing it, you know. It was just, the lights would go on, and the, you know, that was the thing where the you turn the lights on, that's kind of the signal, everybody has to get out. But you know, they would let us play like two records, and everybody would, I would see everybody's face. Oh, it's magic. And at that time, you know, that was the best slot, man, that back then. The closing, now things are different, you know what I mean? But the closing slot back then was like, people stay till the end, you know?
Yeah. So what the closing slot, what time would that be? What time of the night or day would that be?
We would close like 4 or 5 in the morning. So that would be like 3 to 5 or 2 to 4:30, depending on, you know, how busy the night was. But for the most part, yeah, we went late.
Yeah, yeah. And so, yeah. I mean, so what did that do for your career? Kind of like, what kind of year was that? That was like, what, the 90s?
That was mid-90s. That was like, I want to say around 96, 97.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Around that time. And all that led to like, that was all like, that's school for me. All that, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like playing there, playing Limelight, playing at Save the Robots.
Yeah.
Zaftars, I used to do with Kiyoki, good friend of mine. He's another one I'm so grateful for, because these guys gave me the opportunity. You know what I mean? Kiyoki was the shit back then. You know what I mean? He king of New York in that world, like during the 90s, when he was the resident at Disco 2000 at Limelight on Wednesdays. Mm-hmm. And that was like the best party back then. And he was the resident, and he let me open up for him a bunch of times. And then he started this after hours called Save the Robots on Thursdays. Mm-hmm. And he made me his resident. Wow. And that was DJ school for me, because I learned so much there. Yeah. And that's where I learned long sets. Mm-hmm. Because there were times where, you know, sometimes Kiyoki wouldn't make it, and I played all night, 12 hours.
Wow, 12 hours.
Oh, yeah, 10 hours till they left. You know what I mean? Wow. We would start at 3 in the morning and till they left. Sometimes 3 in the afternoon.
I mean, that's insane. And we're talking about an era that was on vinyl only, right? So
you don't understand how many crates of record I was lugging. I don't miss that shit, bro. back problems because lugging records through airports. Yeah. People are like, how come you don't play vinyl? Like, vinyl? I have 20,000 records in the storage right here. Rock, why don't play vinyl?
Oh man, so I mean, yeah, so you were like lugging that around. Were you actually taking it to the club, or were you having to store it at the club?
Oh yeah. I had friends that would help me lug boxes, like for long sets. I always, for Save the Robots, I always brought a lot of records, because I knew I was going to get a chance to play a longer set. Mm-hmm. And yeah, sometimes I bring like two or three of the big boxes. Those things are heavy. It was like 90 pounds.
Yeah. I mean, and do you think, like, thinking about just in terms of technology, now we're kind of talking about it a bit, like, do you think playing off a vinyl when you've only got those records to choose from, and there's, you know, you're kind of funneled by that, compared to USB, you can have hundreds of thousands of tracks
on. Yeah, everything so much works. Well, just life is just easier.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can play anything, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I can, with a USB stick, I can go play 24 hours if I want. It's crazy. That's amazing. But, you know, it's pros and cons. You know what I mean? Pros is that you have access to all this type of music. You can go anywhere. Yeah. Cons is that you kind of just like, it's too much. Like, you don't even know what you have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or, you know, it's hard. I find it so hard to understand what a track is when I'm reading a name of it. It's like, it's always, for me, it was the color of the label or the sleeve. That's or
me. Artwork. Yeah. Artwork, 100%.
Always the artwork.
I didn't do that.
Yeah.
It was always the artwork, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so, you know, when you're approaching a set and you're playing somewhere like Save the Robots, you've got the potential to either play your set or play all night long. I mean, how do you approach that in terms of how you want to start off and build and tell your story, and, you know, what are you looking for in the crowd and those types of things?
It depends. Like, for me, when I'm going to go into, I mean, for me, it's always been my favorite to do the longer sets, because mm-hmm. I can kind of tell the story and go everywhere. Because I like to play all kinds of stuff. I don't like to just stick one specific sound.
Yeah.
So I kind of like, for me, it depends. Well, at Save the Robots, it was kind of weird, because there were times that I was, you know, I would play 2 to 3 hours, but, you know, if Kiyoki, you know, didn't show up, you know, I went straight in. But I mean, so I would just kind of start with kind of the records I had.
Yeah.
But that's, and then if he wasn't showing up, then I just kind of go into everything. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's a pleasure playing for longer sets, because it's just, which is great, because you can kind of just, I love playing open to close. That's like my shit. Cause see everybody walking in and the whole development of the floor till mm-hmm. they leave. You know? Mm-hmm. Like I have a residency that I've been doing in Montreal for decades at Stereo.
Yeah.
Now I'm doing it at Stereo Bar, which is the more like kind of like the earlier room, not the after hours. Mm-hmm. And I just played last week, and every time I play there, I play 5 hours, sometimes, you know, five and a half. And it's just, I love it. You know, open to close, you know, all night. And I take you everywhere. I just posted a set, actually.
I know. I saw that today, actually. So yeah,
it's on my... to the set, you see the whole development. I play everything. I go everywhere.
Yeah, it's on my list. It's on your SoundCloud, isn't it? So yeah, I need to check that out. Definitely. And yeah, like you say, for me, like when I see a DJ, I love not really knowing what's going to come next, rather than be like, oh, you've only got 1 hour of this person, so you pretty much know what you're going to get.
They're playing with their best for that 1 hour. And I mean, you know, a lot of the times it happens, but, you know, it's just how it is now, you know. It's just like where you start playing and like half an hour in, you're starting to get into it. You know what I mean? Like 45 minutes in, you're in it. Uh-huh. And then that's right, someone else is going on.
And that's it. I mean, and how do you work with, you know, when you are, I suppose, from those residency days as well, when you are kind of setting the scene for someone else, perhaps, you know, how would you work with them? What conversations would you be having with them about where you've got to leave it for them? Or would you just do your thing?
I feel like that's like DJing 101. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That's DJ etiquette, mm-hmm. where you kind of like, you know, if you know what that specific person is going to play, you kind of just figure what, you know, what would be the best to complement to what he's going to do.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I've always felt like that's DJ etiquette.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like every DJ should know that. And if you don't, then what are you doing? Then you're playing for yourself. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's just like it's DJ etiquette. You don't want to kind of just like, it has to make sense of what's happening through the night. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like whatever that, whoever's, you know, you're opening for example, is playing, you know. So for what I would do is I would just kind of figure out what would complement what he's doing without kind of like trying to like, you know, be better here at all. You know, just basically just trying to set the night, you know what I mean? Yeah. Set it to what, you know, what the peak will be, you know? Mm-hmm. So if someone's playing Afro House, for example, I would just kind of play like, start like house, maybe start percussive-y, kind of going towards the percussiveness, mm-hmm. towards like building it to when that person goes on. Yeah. I don't know. I feel like that's DJ etiquette.
Totally. And you know, you don't want to step on what they're going to be trying to do for themselves either, but you've got to get it to a point where, you know, the handover is, you know, it doesn't feel like there's a big step change. I mean, how have you found that? Obviously, you know, you're so experienced. How have you found that when you've been on the other side of that and you were walking into a club and there are some DJs and, you know, that etiquette, you know, does it always exist still in the modern day?
It does, but not all the time. I mean, you know, not all the time, but it does. For the most part, I feel like, you know, I get it. Like from people that have opened up for me have kind of been usually people that kind of tend to like my music and, mm-hmm. which kind of makes sense, you know what I mean? But I mean, you know, I don't know. You still get every once in a while, you get someone that, you know, without, you know, etiquette. You got to learn the etiquette. You got to like, I don't know. I've always like felt like getting it when anything I ever got into, I always wanted to learn everything about it. You know what I mean? I feel like it's, you know, it's important. You know what I mean? If you're a painter, don't you want to know who the best painters are? Who's before you? Mm-hmm. You know, who's the reason why you're doing what you do? Who inspired you? You know, I want to know everything about that person. For me, it was when I started DJing. I wanted to know everything about Paradise Garage, about Chicago, about like, you know, Ron Hardy, all these guys that are like, wow. Like now I like listen to, I try to find their mixes, you know, because it's just, you know, that's school 101. That's like history. Know the history of whatever it is you're doing.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so absolutely.
Just, like, the reason I'm bringing that up is because, you know, you're asking about like etiquette and like, mm-hmm. and all that. Then it's just kind of know the history of, you know, if you're opening up for somebody, know what this person's about, know what they're doing, you know, it's part of it, you know?
Yeah.
Sometimes you don't like that.
Yeah, and I mean, this, you know, what this podcast is all about, we're talking to people and just like peeling back the layers of that history and making sure that it's documented and people are telling their own experiences through it. We've had some amazing conversations over it. You're going to be episode 60. So, you know, wow. We've done quite a few. I mean, so in terms of like where you were back in like that era of the mid 90s and then moving forward, like where did like the touring start coming and where did you feel like you're actually making inroads into becoming known outside of the US or outside of New York?
So basically it was, okay, I'm 17. It's like early, it's like now I'm 18. Now it's like beginning of the 90s. I started playing and I got this residency with the Roxy and I just kind of like, now I'm known here in New York, mm-hmm. only New York. Mm-hmm. So now I'm like killing it here. I'm like, all right, this is, now it's like a point where we're killing it. The Roxy's killing it. After Hours is killing it. Packed. And around 97, 98, things start shifting. Mm-hmm. I noticed that all these producers are starting to get booked. And I saw it. I saw the shift from beginning with when we started doing the Roxy to like all of a sudden, these guys that have made big records are getting booked. And I'm like, oh, shit, you know, they were DJs, they're ill producers. I didn't know that. And but that's what happened. It just it was a shift where, like, if you made a dope record, people want to hire you as a DJ.
Yeah.
Which I kind of never understood, because one thing is a great producer, another thing is a great DJ. Mm-hmm. They're two separate things. Mm-hmm. One thing is knowing how to rock a dancer, another thing is knowing how to rock that your equipment in that studio, you know? And so I noticed the shift. So I was like, oh shit, I need to start making some records. Mm-hmm. And that's what got me into production. It's so funny because I started making records so I can keep DJing. So it's so ironic, because and then I ended up loving production. But I mean, that's how I got into production, because I was never really interested in production. I was just so into, like, connecting with a crowd, you know. Mm-hmm. And then it just kind of, like, I noticed that everybody, you know, these guys started getting booked as DJs. So I was like, oh shit, I gotta start making some records. And I started kind of dabbling into that world, and that's what set me off into making records. I think I made my first record in 97 mm-hmm. in Germany. I did it. I met some kids from Germany. I went to Munich. I remember I stayed out in Munich, and I worked with this kid, Jerome, actually. I made my first record in his studio. He had a great studio over there. Mm-hmm. And that set off my production world. And that kind of started where I started dabbling. I started kind of putting together a little studio. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at those times, you have to understand, those times, you know, to have a studio was not cheap. Now you have a laptop in a studio. But, like, back then, it was expensive. You know, I remember when I built my first studio, I had one sampler that was like $4,000. You know, now your computer, you can sample anything in your computer. Back then, it was in a little tiny screen like this that I had to edit with a jog wheel. I don't miss that shit, bro. You know, back, because now I can, you know, I have like this huge screen. I can edit it. Everything's so easy to edit a sample. Mm. You know, back then I was like this on a little screen with a jog wheel. So it's just like, I remember I had a synthesizer, which was like almost $3,000, mm-hmm. and a drum machine, and all this stuff was expensive, man. So it took me a while to put that together.
Yeah.
And when I finally had a decent little studio set up, I just got in it, man.
Yeah. And like, how did you learn? Were you all self-taught? I mean, like, there was like no YouTube really, you know?
And I had a few friends that I call them tech support, because they would just like always help me out. This one guy, Michael Mandel, we used to call him MIDI Mike. And any MIDI questions, I would always be like, Mike, help me out, bro. What do I do? Because I was always having MIDI issues.
Yeah.
And for the most part, I pretty much self-taught, man. I learned, and I'm stubborn too. I'm like, I can't sit there and start reading manuals. So I just trial and error.
Yeah. You learn through doing, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Just, and that's kind of how, like, just, you know, the wanting to do it, mm-hmm. I feel like I learned pretty quick. And like, I had people helping me, like I said, my friend Michael Mandel, he was a big part of helping me.
Yeah.
Like, as far as in the production, because this guy is, like, you know, so good at that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And, then I kind of just got into that whole world, and I started kind of getting little recognition and stuff. But then I had one record that set it off for me. Mm-hmm. That kind of just, because you asked about the whole, when did I get into the whole international scale?
Yeah.
That one record set my whole international career. It's a record I did. Mm-hmm. It's funny. I tell the story of the record. I did this record called Hold On To Your Love, mm-hmm. right? The vocal track in 91, I believe. Mm. And I was on a gig in St. Louis, and I had made this record 2 years prior, and I would just play it from time to time. Mm-hmm. It was an instrumental. And I met this, like, this kind of R&B singer, this kid, Troy Dillard, in St. Louis at some party. Mm-hmm. And he's like, hey man, you know, I'm a singer, you know, I'd love to, like, get together with you and this and that. And it just so happened that, you know, like, he was just like, hey, we're doing this little jam at after hours at our house if you want to come through. And I never do that back then. You know, I was just like, I was very selective where I went. I was just like, all right, fuck it, I'll go hang out. I've never been here. I had my first time over there. Mm-hmm. And I met him, and he was at the party, and he was just singing, like, freestyling. And I was like, oh shit, this guy can sing. Mm-hmm. And somehow I was just like, yo, I played him that one of the instrumentals that I had. At that time, I used to walk around with a little DAT machine, digital audio tape, just before CDs. Mm-hmm. And so I would record stuff on the road and whatever to sample. So I was like, I had my little DAT man with me, and I was like, hey, you know, why don't we just record a scratch and then we'll, like, somehow figure it out and record it proper. Mm-hmm. And he's just like, all right. So I remember I had my little DAT machine. We played it on a tape we were in some living room, and he recorded, and I plugged in my headphones into the mic jack of the dad. Bang, basically through my headphones. And that's how Hold On To Your Love happened.
No way.
He wrote that song that morning. It was like 4 in the morning, 5 in the morning.
Yeah.
He wrote that. He wrote the lyrics to that song that morning. And then I recorded it like that. Then I went back to New York. I put it in the studio and like I put it together. And it sounded cool. I mean, it sounded like shitty because he recorded through a mic, through a headphone. For some reason, it had this like weird quality.
Mm-hmm.
Like people try to emulate that sound now. You know what I mean? They think, yo, what plugin did you run that through? I'm like, plugin? We didn't have any plugins. This was like some headphone. It sounded like, I thought it sounded like shit at the time.
Yeah.
And it just, this weird quality of like, people put effects on shit now to make it sound like that. It's so funny. And so it was just kind of like, so then I sat on that record and I would play it and I noticed the crowd, it would respond well.
Mm.
And I sat on that record for like years, I remember. And I was just like, I didn't know what to do with it. I was like, I don't know if I'm going to put it out. And I remember this other DJ at the time, Onions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He was like, yo, bro, I love that record, man. Can we put it out? And I was like, I don't know. I don't know what I'm going to do with it. And he's just like, oh, he really wanted that record. And I was like, all right, let's do it. Let's put it out. And basically, you know, he's like, let's do a remix of the track. So, you know, for a package deal. So we did a remix of the track. And he put the record on his label. He put the record out, though, you know, as a collaboration when it really wasn't. But he basically, you know, that record went on. It's so ironic because that record went on to establish my career.
Yeah, yeah. And you've been sat on it for so long.
Man, yeah. That record, I got 2 world tours off that record. Literally. It's like this, like through Europe and through the West Coast.
Uh-huh.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Taking that plunge, spotting that angle of being like, right, I need to produce my own stuff, and then taking that plunge to do it, and then that opening the next door to your career, that's like, you know, that's great, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm happy I did, because, you know, I feel like, you know, that was the universe kind of being like, okay, this is next, you know?
Yeah.
I kind of always embrace change and embrace things because I feel like, you know, it's something new, you know? So mm-hmm. It's just like, that's why with music, I look, that's kind of like my perspective. That's why I just like, I like to go everywhere. Sometimes people are like, yo, why you make so many different sounds? It confuses people. I'm like, man, I love all types of music. So I get bored if I have to sit here and just make all tribal or Afro records.
Yeah.
I want to make some dark shit. I want to make some techno. I want to make vocal stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I like it all. You know? So,
yeah. And you're always working as well. Like, you know, it's
oh, man,
like...
I work out. I mean, because that's who I am, you know, it's part of my life and it makes me happy. You know what I mean? Like, for me, like, people are like, yo, why don't you take a vacation? Like, I'll go out and take a vacation. But when I'm laying on the beach, I'm like, fuck, man, I got this idea, man. I wish I was in a studio. I can lay down.
I can imagine you find it tough to sit still and quiet your mind and just be like, no, you're always thinking.
It's a curse and a blessing, you know what I mean? It really is, because it's just like, it's always on my mind, and it's like, you know, it's great because I, you know, I'm creative and I'm, you know, doing all this cool stuff. But then it's just like curse when I'm sitting there watching a movie with somebody and I'm like, stop that, pause that, rewind it, you know? And they're like, what the fuck? Can we just watch the movie here? Why does everything have to be about music? I'm like trying to sample stuff. I'm trying to like, Shazam stuff.
Amazing. And, you know, so obviously you had the big track. You've been sat on it for ages. And then in 2001, you know, you started up Maya Recordings, your own label. What was the kind of feeling behind that? Why was that time right then? What did you want to achieve with it? And, you know, what was behind the name and all that type of stuff and the vibe you're trying to imprint?
Yeah. The whole objective with the label for me, it was always because I wanted a home for my music because I make so much music. You know what I mean? So it's just like I wanted somewhere where I could just put out anything I wanted and I wouldn't have to hear anything from anybody like, oh, that's not going to fit. That's not going to sell. None of that shit. It was just kind of like I wanted a home for it, mm-hmm. for everything that I wanted to put out. So, I mean, in retrospect, maybe if I had approached the label a little differently, it'd probably be a bigger brand. But for me, it was always kind of like my, you know, home for my music. It wasn't like I wanted to blow up this brand and huge, you know, that mm-hmm. was never the objective. The objective was a home for my music, which is why, you know, 90% of the releases are mine on there. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it was just like, so that was the whole concept of the label was somewhere I can just showcase all my music. And I had a daughter, my daughter in 1999, Maya, mm-hmm. which I named the label after her because I've always been fascinated with Mayan culture. And I was, that was so cool. And I named it after her. So Maya Records comes from her. People are like, oh, you know, I mean, obviously the you know, the Mayan culture is amazing, mm-hmm. but I mean, it's, I it was to like, you know, commemorate her. I just had my, you know, my first kid, you know?
Oh man, that's beautiful. I love that.
Yeah. We have a good relationship. She lives here in Brooklyn as well.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, so that you say a lot of the output is, you know, your own stuff. In terms of your creative process, where is your studio now? I mean, where are you right now? How close is your studio to your home? Is that a good or bad thing at being close or further away, or what?
My studio is across the street. Literally like 50 feet from my building.
Uh-huh.
I live in this amazing space. This building is over 100 years old. It's mm-hmm. all musicians and artists in this building. It's like a little, like, it's like this old factory building that's all like creators pretty much living in here,
yeah,
which is why I'm here. It's like I said, it's the universe put me here, mm-hmm. which is for me to just keep growing, because ever since I've been here, I've just kept growing, because it's just, since I've moved here, it's just, my life has just changed for the better. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, just being here, my boy next door, this guy Tariq Khan, he's an insane producer, mm-hmm. works with like the Roots, with like all these amazing people, mm-hmm. and all these people since I've been living here have been pivotal for me just to move forward on the whole production. And because since I've been here, I've stepped up my studio, is, you know, and I've stuff that I've learned from them, and working with these amazing producers and engineers that work with all these big greats, yeah. you know, that live here and like work here, is been, you know, pivotal for me. Amazing.
Yeah.
So like, yeah, I live in this loft space, and my studio is across the street in this other building that's just all musicians.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. So yeah. I have access so many musicians, which is like, for me, it's invaluable, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, that's great. And so when you're thinking about collaborating, or you need someone to do something live for you, or a vocalist or something like that, you know, how do you work in the studio? Do you find it a solo affair for your own good, or do you like to collaborate? Do you want to do it virtually? Do you want to get people live in the studio? How does that work?
Both. I mean, I love to collaborate, because collaborating, you just bring something else to the table. It's two different minds, two different perspectives, which is always is great. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So I love collaborating, and but I also love solo. I mean, I love working alone. You know what I mean? I like to kind of, because I work in a specific way where it's like efficiently. I like to work efficient. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I just kind of like to keep moving. I don't like to get stuck on certain things. And, you know, that can play a, you know, that can, if you're collaborating with somebody, that can kind of, you know, it depends on who, you know, because I work with Harry Romero, and he's like, we're like beasts in there. Yeah. Like, we get in the studio, I'll go to his house, and he has a studio at home, and, you know, I'll leave there in like one day we've made three tracks front to back, mixed and everything. Because you know his workflow is like mine. We work really efficient.
Yeah.
And but I love to work with musicians. You know what I mean? Because that's so inspiring. You know, these are different. And like usually I work with a lot of like jazz musicians and neo soul musicians, which is great because it's really inspiring what they're bringing, what their perspective is on what I'm doing. You know.
Yeah.
So I love that. And since I've been here, I've been able to work with a lot of musicians, which has been a blessing.
Yeah.
Because it's inspiring. Some of these people are so talented, man.
Yeah. A different perspective, like you say. And, you know, so, you know, you work efficiently. We have done an interview with Harry as well on this podcast as well. And I get that sense that, he was exactly
the
same.
Yeah, Harry's a beast in the studio.
Absolute beast. Yeah. And, you know, how do you know when something is finished? You know, do you have a problem with stopping stuff and being like, that's done? Do you like to road test stuff and then take it back and tweak it? Like, how does
I road test it? I road test mix it mainly on my mix downs, you know, where I like I'll mix it and then I'll take it out and road test and be like, oh, maybe, you know, bring the vocal up a couple of dBs, stuff like that, you know, bass, whatever, fine tune the bass. But for the most part, I feel like it has to do with confidence, man, is knowing that, you know, this shit sounds good. You know what I mean? And I believe it sounds good and it's done. You know what I mean? That's kind of how I feel.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like it has a lot to do with that because, you know, it's like an artist, like no work's ever done, but it's you're confident enough to know that it's good and it's, you know, and it's worthy of being done, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you want to make a few little changes to it because I'm always constantly making little changes to stuff. But it's knowing that, you know, it sounds good and it's ready. You know, that has to do, I feel, with confidence.
Yeah, yeah. And is there ever like a disappointing bit where you absolutely are confident in something and then it just hasn't worked for whatever reason?
Oh, yeah. Of course, it's happened. You know, it's happened. And it's usually it's happened with a mix.
Mm-hmm.
Like if I've moved studios or where I just kind of just get learning, you know, because every room is different. And like learning the room, I've learned where I've done mixes where I'm like, ooh, this could be so much better. And it's just like that usually happens to me when I'm just learning a new room that I've just moved in or I've just bought new monitors and everything takes getting used to, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like for me, that's been times where I've heard like, oh man, that bass sounds terrible. I need to revisit that. But I mean, yeah, but that's kind of been because of, you know, like I moved my studio and like I said, and I wasn't used to the room and I thought the mix sounded right. But, you know, when I took it and played it out, I'm like, ugh.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so what would you say if someone asked you, well, I'm going to ask you to describe like your sound, like encapsulate it, not necessarily in like, you know, pigeonholed in like, you know, tribal house or, you know, tech house or whatever. You know, if you like what's most personal to you in terms of what vibe and the soul that you're looking to put into your sound, well, how would you describe
it? For me, it's always been like the deeper stuff,
mm-hmm.
the really kind of like not so much melodic, but just more psychedelic, you know, like very delayed effect. You know, I love reggae dub music.
Uh-huh,
huge fan of dub. Because I've always loved the, you know, that whole tape delay dub vibe. I've always thought it was so cool.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, I incorporate that shit in all of my music, you know. So I would say it's Latin influence, darker techno. I can't say because it's just so many types of music I love and so many types of music I make.
Mm-hmm.
So I make all types of stuff. Like just for example, this week I made two vocal tracks. I made a darker techno track. You know, I mean, and then I made like this other Afro track, you know what I mean? So it's kind of like, I love all that. So whatever I go, when I'm in the studio and I, you know, whatever I'm feeling, and then I do Latin stuff too. You know what I mean? I love making a lot of like Latin influence stuff, like straight up horns and everything.
Yeah. So I did read somewhere that you were thinking about maybe an album for 2024. Is that on the agenda?
I've been working on that for a while. Yeah. We got something in the process, doing an album for Damien Lazarus for Crosstown Rebels.
Uh-huh.
And I love Damien. I love the stuff that I've been, I sent him, like usually the stuff I put out on Crosstown is more kind of reggae dubby type of stuff. So this album is going to be across the board, everything like that I love, you know what I mean? For me, and even like slower stuff, like that more like, you know, 120 BPM is kind of, I'm experimenting on this, just going everywhere, everything I love. And yeah, super excited for this album. I've been working on it for a while. I'm still working on it.
When you say a while, I mean, do you think 2024 is ambitious when you're saying it like that?
No, it's done. I'm there, but I'm just finalizing. It's more so what tracks that we're gonna go with. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Mm-hmm. I have so much stuff, man. I work so much. You know what I mean? I'm in the studio constantly, and it's crazy. You know, sometimes I'm like, damn, I make like 9 tracks in a week, 10 tracks in a week. You know, it's just like,
that's insane.
Oh yeah, yeah. Oh yeah. Because it's what I enjoy doing, and this is what I want to do. I wake up and I work.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I don't really see it like work. I'm seeing I'm in there having fun. You know, mm-hmm. but yeah. So my work is, you know, man, I have a drive with over 100 unreleased tracks, and I have to figure out what I'm gonna do. Like place. Thing I'm out of my label and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And those unreleased ones, you know, are those ones that when you're playing out, you're playing the majority of your own stuff?
Yeah, I play some of them, yeah. I did an all unreleased set on Mixmag Live once. And it's just I did a set of all my unreleased music at the time.
And what was the reaction like? Were people clamoring for stuff on the back of that? Yeah.
Yeah, it was cool because it was just some edits I've done, some bootlegs, mm-hmm. and a bunch of unreleased stuff. Yeah, it was cool. I should do that more often, actually.
Well, you got the selection to do it by the sounds.
I have the selection very much. You know, before I put them out, yeah, for sure.
Absolutely. I mean, so what else have you got kind of going on like right now? What are you excited about? Are you looking, is 2023 over for you? Are you looking forward to the next year? Have you got any tours planned? You know, are you going to Ibiza or anything like that?
Yeah, I'm excited for what the future brings. I mean, this album I'm excited for. Mm-hmm. And just really cool stuff happening. Like, you know, some really solid releases on Maya. Some really good stuff coming out. Some collaborations that I've done. Mm-hmm. Setting off the year, I'm doing Goa, India for New Year's.
Oh,
I'm
wow.
looking forward to that.
Have you been there before?
Oh, my first time in India. Definitely my bucket list of countries. And so I'm really excited about that. Then we're doing South America for January. I finally got my cover for Mixmag Brazil.
Oh,
my first cover. Like,
congratulations.
So we're doing a tour to set that off for January in Brazil and South America.
Yeah.
And obviously I'm doing Tulum.
Yeah.
A0. But it's a lot of good stuff. Usually January and February has always kind of been more South America for me.
Yeah.
Because that's the best time over there.
Yeah.
So I usually work a lot during over there. And in the summer's Europe for sure.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah.
We got a busy schedule coming up. So I'm really looking forward to everything. And just, you know, pushing the label forward to where I just have some people now handling the label because it's just too much. You know what I mean? With my schedule. And
yeah.
I had a good friend of mine, he handled all the label stuff. And you know, now that I was doing it myself, it kind of wasn't really getting handled the way it should. Now he's back at it, and we're moving full steam.
Yeah, I mean, you're a busy guy, right? So, and like, look, you're always looking forward. You're always pushing your sound forward as well. You know, when you're on tour and you go to certain places, you know, you mentioned Goa, bucket list. You've not been there before. Are you always looking for new places that you've to new experiences and new places to play, or do you like to go back and be like, I love playing in this one particular place as well, I'm happy to always go back there?
I'm always excited for somewhere I've never been because I don't know what to expect, you know what I mean? And India is like, you know, amazing country. Such cool. So, and I've heard, so I mean, you know, Goa, I heard it's beautiful. I've never been over there, so like I all my friends that have been there, oh, you're gonna love it, have fun, don't drink the water.
Yeah, no, don't drink the water.
So I love traveling and like mm-hmm. learning new cultures. So that's always been a big bonus of like traveling abroad, mm-hmm. is that I've gotten able to do that, try the foods. And you know. But yeah, I'm excited, man. I'm excited to go over there, you know, and it's New Year's. So it's a special night to play over there. It's anywhere, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So when you're playing a gig like that, do you know what you're going to play it like? If you're playing over midnight, like what tunes are you going to drop in there, anything like that? Anything in the back of your mind? No idea.
I mean, I'm starting to think about it. I know, I feel like I like to play what I feel like is appropriate for where I'm at.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like setting wise, I feel like if I'm playing on a beach, I want to play a little bit more organic stuff. You know what I mean? Which makes sense, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's just, but I don't know. I'm definitely going to, you know, I'm going to just do me, but I mean, for sure, I feel like I'm gonna go a little bit more percussive and stuff out here because it makes sense, you know. If I'm playing, say, on this beach, it's just like it makes sense.
Yeah, that'd be stunning. So, I mean, we're talking about tunes, and it's kind of the time in the interview to talk about your tunes and track selections for our House Culture Perfect playlist, which is on Spotify. And yeah, we've been doing this since the first episode. Every single guest has submitted five tracks based on different themes for this playlist. So, you know, it's over 30 hours long now, I think, to be honest with you. And there's some.
Well, congratulations, man. You guys episode 60,
I
damn.
know. I can't believe it either, to be honest. When we started off the episode numbers and we did 001, I was like, why don't we just put 01? It's been massively ambitious, but yeah, we're getting there. So it's good fun, and yeah, and obviously you're
Really
part
cool
of
what
that
you guys
now.
are doing. I
Yeah.
think it's really cool what you guys are doing because you're basically, you know, you're educating the masses because it's just like, you know, in this business that's grown so much, you know, I feel like it's really important to know the roots of it, you know, the people that were there before you. So I commend you guys on that.
Cool, thank you. No, I really appreciate that. And that's it. Yeah, that's exactly what we're all about, to be honest with you. It's just all about us having this passion for this scene and watching it grow and looking back. You know, I've got my own experience through the scene, and like the other people that we do this house culture thing with, they've got their own experiences, and we're all completely different. And we're all so interested in like how each one has like got to where we are now. It's yeah, and you know, speaking to other people about their journeys is always super interesting. But yeah, so in terms of the Spotify playlist, the tracks, we always start off with a catalyst track, a track that kind of got you into
And
dance
I mean,
music,
that was
electronic
a tough
music.
question for me because there was so many. But this one, you know, there's like records that just, you know, whenever I walk into the studio, always are in the back of my head, which is like the one I wrote, which is the Blake Baxter when we used to play in that record. I still love that record. And it's just there's certain records like that, Little Louis French Kiss. These records are just like timeless, you know. It's it was so ahead of their time, you know.
Yeah, so Blake
But
Baxter, when we used to play, I mean, yeah, you can
yeah.
see, and like you say, Little Louis as well, you can still play these out now and you can still hear them
Oh
out now
yeah.
and they still sound fantastic. I mean,
AMS, I mean Kevin Saunderson, those guys, look what they've done throughout. That label is amazing. I mean, techno is just Detroit techno's
yeah.
finest.
So, I mean, where were you when you first heard that and what was your reaction to
Man,
that?
I remember I was at this club called The Saint.
So the Saint is the one with the dome,
In the
right?
sphere. It was in the sphere. So it's like it looked like you're in like a planetarium when you walked in, and it was just like it was what a club,
I've
man. I
just seen
remember.
photos of it. It looks
Yeah,
sensational.
this was in the 80s. God, I'm old. This is in the late 80s, yeah. And I remember like I used to go there. It was like there was this gay club. Because at that time, the best clubs in New York were the gay scene. And I remember I used to go there. And I heard that record, and it was just the bass line was just everything to me when I first heard it. And I was just like, oh my God, what is this? And I remember just going, because he played it as a promo. I hadn't come out, and I was going crazy. You know, things are a lot different. You know, things back then, try to find the record that a DJ played, good luck. You know what I mean? Like,
Absolutely.
you know, the one that goes ding, 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 ding. Now you just Shazam, boom, it's just everything out there on some podcast. Even trying to hear it on someone's mixes was impossible. How was I going to do that? I remember, you know, I heard it and I was just like, and then he played it like a bunch of times when I forgot who was DJing. So, it could have been David Morales, if I'm not
No
mistaken.
way.
Yeah, because David was like, he used to play some really cool stuff back then. I used to do the Red Zone. I think he used to play it too. The Red Zone in New York, that was, oh man, that was school for me too. And David Morales used to kill that room. Wow.
Oh, I mean, we've spoken to David Morales on this
Wow,
podcast as well.
man.
I say we've spoken to him. I just asked him one question, and I think he spoke for an hour. It was absolutely brilliant.
Bro, he was just like, that was school for me. I remember I used to go to the Red Zone all the time, and that was his home. And he would experiment there. He would just play just really trippy. It's so good, man. Inspiring.
Completely. So, the next choice is the Floor Filler, and this
Yeah,
is the one that I'm sure everyone knows from yourself.
for me, this one. You know, this was like I think my biggest record in the last decade. Like, you know, where I was surprised that the people responded so well to it because it's kind of like, you know, It's more of a Latin, you know, you kind of it's a Latin sample, it's a salsa sample, so it's kind of like it's not really not everybody's into salsa music, you know. So just I was surprised how big, because this record ended up like I've heard like techno guys play it, house guys play it, Afro guys, everybody played it, and it was my record that just worked. So whenever I feel like I need a little energy burst, I just drop it and it always works. The breakdown is just it just works for me. Like the energy shifts, it's always just like just a good energy record for me.
And it's called Dia de Aya. Am I mangling that, or is that
It's feature Hector Lavoe. That's another thing. Hector Lavoe is like one of the legendary salsa singers from the 70s. And my mom used to listen to that record when we was she was cleaning the house in like, you know, in the 80s. And I sampled him from that. And which is genius, because I remember I was just like, there's no way I'm gonna clear this sample because this is from Fania, who owns the rights to the. And I remember I remember, you know, it's like, how am I going to release this record? I was just like, I can't release it, because I contacted them and they wanted all this crazy money to license it. And I was remember thinking like, damn, I guess I'm just going to be playing it. And then the late Eric Murillo, rest in peace, it's that brother, him, he heard it. He's like, Joe, this record is the shit. I'm putting this out. I'm like, well, we have to license it. Funny, you know, for him, that was like 10 G's here, no problem. You know what I mean? And he licensed it, and we were able to put it out on his label, Sondos.
It's on us, yeah.
And it's great because I got to have my name. That was like my goal, was to have my name next to his for my to show that to my mom, and she was so happy.
Oh, that's so good. That's so cool. Amazing. So, a sunsetter. You're talking about like obviously playing on a beach and thinking forward to that time in India that you're going to have. What have you chosen for your sunsetter?
Yeah, thanks, Fernando. I haven't even like thought about it, but like this for me, a sunset song has to be something beautiful. You know what I mean? Something beautiful, the motion. That's why I chose the because Damaz, this Brazilian producer that's kind of killing it right now. I'm loving what he's doing, and that's one of my favorite remixes he's done. So that's I've played that record plenty sunsets before.
Yeah, so it's Zeca Veloso.
That's a Brazilian artist, yeah, and he remixed it, and he did like this great like remix of it. I've been really following his stuff and really vibing on what he's doing.
Cool. It's a great choice. Okay. So a tearjerker.
Tearjerker.
These are the
Anything
mad
emotional?
choices that we get, but sometimes people go completely left field. Some people choose something from like dance music or whatever. What you've chosen the Ananda Project, Cascades of Color, the
Yeah,
Joe
man, that
Clausel
record,
Sacred
man, it
Rhythm
brings back
Mix.
good memories for me, you know. And it's just a beautiful record. The vocal is just amazing, like really touching. And Joe Clausel's remix is beautiful, beautiful. So it's just one of those records that for me, it makes me emotional. So that's why I chose that as a tearjerker. Makes me jerk a few tears.
So yeah, are you a fan of playing it out or anything like that, or is it you
I've
know?
played it out a bunch of times. Yeah, I played that record out a bunch of times. Yeah, it's like it's one of those things, you know, like I feel like every record, every track, every song has a time and a place where it shines. You know what I mean? Because it could like shine in one place and annihilate a dance floor on another, or just clear a floor on another one. You know what I mean? So every record has its time where it'll shine. A record like that will shine at sunrise for the right crowd. You know, everybody's feeling amazing, and something like that, it'd be really special. But then, you know, you played at the wrong time. People be like, what is this? You know, it sucks, you
Well, I
know.
mean, and that's the style of a decent DJ, understanding which moment
Knowing
when.
when to play what and what to play. Yeah, that's DJing 101.
Cool. All right. So last tune, you alluded to this tune with your residency at
That was a
Together.
hard one for me too, because there's so many that I used to close with that I loved. But this one of them, I did an edit, and I put the original version on this one because it's Spotify, because I did an edit of it. That was the one I used to play, but it's not on Spotify. So that's why I was like, man, what do I do? So I'm like, let me just throw the original. I did an edit like from like the middle on, and it's just that record just killed. And it was just like the crowd would sing it. It's just magic.
Yeah, Love Committee, Just As Long As I Got You. And that, yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of my journey through house music, dance music, is hearing something that sampled that first and then going and discovering the original. And that was Seamus Haji, Big Bang Theory did God's Child. And that's always for that's me is the God's Child one. Yeah.
Yeah, but, yeah, I love it. I love all the stuff he used to do, man. Some of them.
Yeah. But no, the original, when you go back and you discover those originals and you're like, holy shit, these are absolutely amazing. Yeah.
That's where that comes from.
Yeah.
Everything comes from something, you know what I mean? Even if it's an inspiration, even if it's something original, it comes from someone like thinking of something that they loved and you know, that inspiring that, you know?
So when you were like, had that residency and you were playing these tunes, was there an expectation that you would play this one or that one or whatever?
Oh yeah, people knew these are the records that I played towards the end, you know.
Yeah.
Like it, that one, it was Together by Merk, you know, Merk Brothers. That was like a just specific sometimes Reach for Me by Merk.
Yeah.
You know, the records that people like I would play at the end and people knew we would sing them. It's so nice.
Well, I love that. It's amazing. Right, I mean, that's the end. We've got one more question. We always have our final question, which is we are house culture. We've kind of talked about why we exist and what we're doing for the scene and trying to educate people and peel back those layers of, you know, the history of it all. Like, for you, what does house culture mean?
Man, it's for me, it's just happiness. It's who I am. It's what I've been able to do. I mean, you know, it's what my life has been. You know what I mean? I can honestly say that my life has been this my whole life, you know what I mean? And I feel so grateful, so much gratitude that, you know, I can just, you know, and all the friends that I've met along the way doing this, you know, like promoters that I've worked with that work like family now, you know what I mean? It's so I feel, you know, it's everything to me, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it really is. I mean, you know, as you see, my life is, I'm in it, you know, and I wake up, I'm in the studio every day. Weekends, I'm out of town, so I'm in it. You know what I mean? So it's everything to me, man. I feel very grateful that I can still be here doing it, you know? And I'll do it till I can't do it anymore.
Let's end there. That's a brilliant thought to end on. Thank you so much. It's been great to chat to you.
Thank you so much for having me, man. It's really nice chatting with you, bro. Cheers, brother.
House culture.
Now that was a real nice chat, wasn't it? I hope you all learned something from that. I know I certainly did. So I loved hearing that story about how it was someone else's obsession with his sister that set Joski on his journey through dance music. I also want to thank him for gracing our 60th episode and for the kind words he had to say about what we're doing on the podcast. Thanks, Joski. Now, dear listener, if you want to show your support for the podcast as well and get directly involved in what we do, you can come and attend our very first House Culture event happening in February 2024. It's called The Social. It's happening in South London. DJs include myself and Defected and Glitterbox star Katie Goodman, and you can buy tickets from the links pinned on our Instagram page. All proceeds will go to pushing the podcast forward in 2024 and beyond, so please show your support and come and party with House Culture. Some tunes you might hear on the night can be found in amongst our House Culture Perfect playlist on Spotify, that curated collection of tracks chosen by our previous podcast guests. Just search for House Culture Perfect playlist, stick it on shuffle, and pump up that volume. Whilst you're on Spotify, you can also now drop us a comment in the Q&A section under the episode description, or if you're on Apple, you can always leave us a review. Feedback is the lifeblood of this show. It makes what we do worthwhile. Share your positive thoughts, and we'll shout you out in a future episode. That special shout out this time goes to Darren Williams, who, after listening to our chat with Todd Terry, said that it was a fantastic episode and that he loved listening to an absolute hero of his. Thank you, Darren. I think Todd is a hero to us all, right? Or maybe just a god. On that somewhat heavenly note, I'd like to say thanks once again for all of your support across this fourth season of the House Culture Podcast. We will be back with season 5 in 2024, but in the meantime, you can get your fix for all things house from our Instagram at HouseCultureNet, or by following the hashtag TrueHouseCulture. And don't forget that you can also reach out to me directly on Instagram at DJ Matt Rouse. Thanks for listening. Rave safe. See you in 2024.
House Culture.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.